From the Voice of America in Washington, this is VOA Asia Weekend. I'm Ira Melman. On today's program,
there's just no question that this is Xi's parade.
China's president gets another five-year term, plus a lot more. The U.S. Secretary of State takes a South Asia tour. In New Delhi, he tells Indian leaders of a new U.S. policy there.
I think India is expected to play a far bigger role in this new strategy than it was earlier.
And the president of the Philippines finds himself facing criticism after a deadly, destructive battle with pro-Islamic militants.
This was a huge embarrassment for a president who tries to portray himself as a strong and decisive leader.
All of that and more this week on VOA Asia Weekend. China's ruling Communist Party unveiled a new leadership lineup for its top decision-making body, the Politburo Standing Committee, the apex of power in the world's second-largest economy. But breaking with precedents, among those named, there was no clear successor. VOA's Bill Ide had more from Beijing.
Strutting out onto the red carpet and led by Chinese President Xi Jinping, China unveiled its new seven-member leadership team Wednesday at a brief invitation-only gathering for the press. VOA and several other international media organizations were not invited. Both Premier Li Keqiang and Xi were reelected. The five other newcomers include two key advisors to Xi, Wang Huning and Li Jianshu. Zhao Leji, the man tapped to become the country's anti-corruption chief, State Council Vice Chairman Wang Yang, and Shanghai Party Secretary Han Zheng. But clearly the focus was on one man alone.
The first plenary session of the 19th Central Committee elected a new central leadership. The Congress re-elected me as the General Secretary. I see this as not just an approval of my work, but also an encouragement that will spur me on.
Increasingly, Xi is seen as China's most powerful leader since Mao Zedong ruled the country. At a tightly scripted party congress that ended Tuesday, he further cemented his authoritarian grip. In a unanimous vote, the Congress added his name and political vision for China to the Communist Party's constitution, an honor no other Chinese leader has been given except for Mao. Xi has big plans for the country and China's communist system.
The Chinese Communist Party is the world's largest political party. If one is big, one must act big. History makes it abundantly clear that the Chinese Communist Party is capable of not only spearheading a great social revolution, but also imposing great revolution on itself.
How long that revolution will last with Xi at the helm is unclear. Among the new leadership team, there was no obvious successor. And with his increased power and ambitious plans laid out at the party congress, many analysts see Xi Jinping staying around for some time to come. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
The just-concluded Chinese Communist Party meeting has left the Chinese President Xi Jinping with a level of power not seen since the days when Mao Zedong led the country. I spoke about Xi's elevation with Clayton Duby, the director of the U.S.-China Institute at the University of California in Los Angeles.
There's just no question that this is Xi's parade. Xi Jinping is very much in command. If you look beyond the individuals that were chosen for the standing committee of the Politburo to the wider Politburo, the vast majority of them, something like two-thirds of them, have a personal connection to Xi Jinping. So it sounds as though factional alignments are a thing of the past, and now you really have him as the dominant figure. At the same time, you also have the idea of party dominance, a reassertion of the centrality of the party and the importance of maintaining a strong party presence in the economy and elsewhere, and reasserting the center's control both over the party and the military that it runs.
There seems to be no obvious successor. You take a look at the age of the people also named to the standing committee. There are a lot of old guys there.
Yes, that would be the case, that none of the individuals included in the standing committee could assume the mantle of general secretary. There are, however, individuals among the Politburo who could be elevated. That doesn't fit the pattern that has existed for the last couple of rounds, where Hu Jintao was first elevated to the Politburo Standing Committee and then became general secretary, and where Xi Jinping was first elevated to the Politburo Standing Committee and then became general secretary. So we do have what appears to be a break in that. It's also possible, since this is not part of the party constitution, that Xi Jinping would have to step down in 2022, that he might elect to continue. He certainly, at this point, has the backing to do that.
Let me move on to another issue, that being the inclusion of the thoughts of Xi Jinping into the Constitution of China. The only other Chinese leader to which that was afforded was Mao. That might bring up some questions and some fears to people outside of China. Should they be afraid of too much of a central power and what might happen, especially looking back at Mao Zedong?
I don't believe that Xi Jinping is Mao Zedong part two. I think Xi Jinping is a Leninist and, in fact, asserts the dominance of the party and his dominance over that party. And Mao certainly wanted that. But, in fact, he launched the Cultural Revolution because he thought he had lost control of the party. He wanted to reach beyond the party and turn the public, and especially young people, against the bureaucratization of the party. And so he sought that kind of change. Also, the Communist Party that Xi Jinping leads has already undergone a tremendous transformation. It no longer is focused on, as Mao would have had it, class struggle, on a socialist revolution in the sense of eradicating inequality and things like that. It's very much focused on building China ever stronger, ever more powerful. And so Xi Jinping is a Leninist of the first order. So was Deng Xiaoping. Elevating his thought, attaching his name to it, simply just confirms that he is, unlike his predecessors, Jiang Zemin and Hu Jintao, very much the person in command.
Clayton Duby, the director of the U.S.-China Institute at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. Clay, as always, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
A senior White House official says when Donald Trump visits China next month, the president will urge his Chinese counterpart, Xi Jinping, to make good on his commitments to pressure North Korea over its nuclear and missile programs. The official said Beijing needs to do more to comply with two previous UN Security Council resolutions approved unanimously. At a Southeast Asian security meeting last Monday, Japan's defense minister warned the threat posed by North Korea has grown to a critical and imminent level. Pyongyang has fired missile tests over Japanese territory. However, Tufts University assistant professor in Korean studies Sung Yoon Lee told VOA's Victor Beatty that such a warning could have been made years ago.
This effectively means that he will stay in power for much longer than the usual 10 years. That is intense discussion amongst party members that Xi Jinping might remain the country's number one leader until the 21st Party Congress in 2027, or even perhaps if his health allows, until the 22nd Party Congress in 2032, when he will be 79 years old.
Was this a surprise?
Well, this is no surprise because from day one, 5 years ago, when he first seized power, Xi Jinping has been methodically laying the groundwork to build up a kind of a Xi Jinping dynasty. In the past 5 years, he has been very successful in grooming a so-called Xi Jinping faction, which has now emerged as the largest faction within the Communist Party. And this faction, consisting of his cronies, proteges, and loyalists, will definitely support his ambition to remain number one in the party and government for at least 15 years, if not 20 years.
What will this mean for Chinese policy?
In terms of political institutions and traditions, this will be a major retrogression, because when Deng Xiaoping, the chief architect of reform, emerged from power after the Cultural Revolution, Deng Xiaoping was adamant in repudiating one-person rule. Deng Xiaoping has forbidden the personality cult to be erected around leaders, and Deng Xiaoping has laid down major institutional changes, such as retirement age and term limits for party and state leaders. So the fact that Xi Jinping is now effectively the emperor for life means that dictatorial traditions, which were the case during the Cultural Revolution, might be reinstated on a large scale.
This comes just about a week and a half or so before President Trump meets President Xi. Do you expect any difference in the way that the two leaders will treat each other?
Now that Xi Jinping has put his house in order, he will devote more resources and energy to boosting China's global position. On the world stage, China will close the gap with the U.S. China will become a full-fledged superpower, able to challenge the U.S., particularly in the Asia-Pacific arena. All in all, we will expect China to aspire to become the rule setter on the global stage in areas ranging from financial arrangements to globalization to world trade.
Sun Yun Lee said moral suasion is not the way to get China on board, but rather imposing economic disincentives on Chinese banks and state-owned enterprises that continue supporting the North Korean regime. An unprecedented Chinese financial and construction effort is rapidly developing Pakistan's strategically located Arabian seaport of Gwadar into one of the world's largest transit and transshipment cargo facilities. VOA's Ayaz Gul reported both sides are hoping to turn the port city into the gateway of a multi-billion dollar bilateral economic corridor being built to connect the two allied nations.
The deep-water Gwadar port lies at the convergence of three of the most commercially important regions of the world, the oil-rich Middle East, Central Asia, and South Asia. Beijing is developing Gwadar as part of the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, known as CPEC. The two countries launched the 15-year project in 2015 to jointly build highways, railways, power plants, communications, and industrial zones in Pakistan, with a Chinese investment initially estimated at $46 billion. The aim is to link Gwadar to landlocked western China to give it a shorter and secure route through Pakistan to global markets. Some in Pakistan are worried skilled Chinese laborers, engineers and businesses will flood the country, hurting domestic industries.
I think it is not true.
Dostain Khan Jamaldini, the top Pakistani administrator at the port, says about 65% of the labor force on construction and other projects at Gwadar is Pakistani, and the number of Chinese is currently just over 300.
Look now, this is the building you can see, which is under construction, all prefabricated with the Chinese technology. For erecting such a massive building in 2 or 3 months, I don't think so that we can do it right now. But yes, with this work, gradually the transfer of technology is also coming to Pakistan. And it will further minimize the presence of Chinese experts and engineers from Pakistan.
Chinese fuel imports and trading cargo will be loaded on trucks and ferried to and from the western Xinjiang region through the Karakoram Highway, snaking past snow-capped peaks in northern Pakistan. Officials anticipate Gwadar will become South Asia's biggest shipping center within 5 years, with a yearly capacity of handling 13 million tons of cargo. And by 2030, they say the port will be handling up to 400 million tons of cargo annually. Security concerns and India's claims over some of the territory crossed by the massive project remain key challenges for Gwadar and CPEC in general. Just beyond Gwadar's two semicircular bays, the Arabian Sea meets the Persian Gulf, and local fishermen ply the crystal blue waters as they have for generations. The coastal city's poverty-stricken residents are mostly fishermen and boat makers. They are hoping new employment opportunities will be created for them in the wake of the massive development underway in Gwadar. But residents say hours-long daily power outages and a scarcity of water are the immediate problems facing them.
We are facing frequent power blackouts and water shortages.
We got no fish today and came back empty handed.
Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Gwadar, Pakistan.
Acid attacks are an all-too-common problem in Pakistan, as in many other countries in South and East Asia. Almost all Pakistani victims are women. VOA's Saman Khan recently visited a center that not only helps victims recover physically from their injuries, but it helps them rebuild their lives.
My husband did this. After I was divorced, I was taking my kids to school. He came from behind and threw acid on me.
Victims often are left so scarred that society rejects them, adding to their pain.
I was in such a bad shape. I was even scared of myself. When I looked into the mirror, I was terrified. Some people even started joking about it. When I would go somewhere, people would say, "She must have been at fault. She must have done something wrong."
Here at the Smile Foundation, attack victims rebuild their lives.
All my surgeries have been done through Ms. Musarat. I have gone through 6 surgeries so far.
The Smile Foundation has helped nearly 800 victims since opening in 2003. Chairwoman Musarat Misbah says some were as young as 3.
On average, a girl has to go through 35 to 40 surgeries before she can begin to look a little better, but they never get their old face back.
After the surgeries are done, the foundation helps the women learn skills so they can earn a living. Another group, the Aurat Foundation, is working to stop acid attacks. It wants to get laws restricting acid sales fully enforced.
The law on acid throwing stipulated that acid sellers would be required to get a license. They have to get that license renewed, but this has never been implemented. It's necessary that the acid bottles priced at 10 to 15 rupees be banned.
Victims also say that the punishment for acid attacks is too lenient.
Those who commit this crime get 14 years in prison. However, they get out after 7 years and live the life they wanted. However, we remain here. We want them to also go through the same ordeal as us, so they can realize how the situation is faced.
For Saman Khan of VOA's Urdu service in Lahore, I am Sahar Majid, VOA News.
In Greek, pneuma means breath and spirit, and that is the core philosophy of a relatively new program in Baltimore, Maryland, with the same name. Pneuma combines exercise, yoga, and leadership training. Behind this program is a near-death experience that made a young man bitter and angry, then led him to become forgiving and proactive.
1, 2, 3, 4. Twice a week, all year long. A group of about 2 dozen boys gathers at Baltimore Police Academy to participate in Pneuma.
What is your vision?
To strive to teach our young men the art of forgiveness, self-control, and discipline.
They joined the program because they had difficulty focusing in school or controlling their impulses. Here, they exercise and meet with adults who care about them, like school principal Nicomar Mosley, who volunteers with the program.
We allow our students to engage in the different push-ups and the sit-ups and things that will build them physically, sometimes with the physical push that helps to keep their minds focused.
Pneuma founder Damian Cooper says other exercises focus on breathing.
We want our young men to understand that oftentimes they're acting off of impulse actions. And they don't think about what they're doing, they just act. So what we try to do is get them to slow down. If you take a deep breath, it slows things down.
And that makes it easier for them to control their anger and learn to forgive. Cooper says it took him more than 4 years to learn this lesson. 24 years ago, he was shot, and the bullet stopped within an inch of his heart. He became very bitter and angry until he decided he had to move on.
I started doing some volunteer work in a prison, and unbeknown to me, for a year and a half, I wound up mentoring the very young man who shot me. And once we found out that this was a young man, I forgave him.
Finding the strength to forgive is one of the lessons Project Pneuma Kids learn. Cooper's 14-year-old son, Nigel, says joining the program is a transforming experience.
My best friends have gone through this program, and they used to always fight no matter what somebody would say to them. But now they calm down to the point where you could push them, and they could look at you and just be like, shrug their shoulders.
The participants range in age from 9 to 14.
As we look at the older students, they work together to help the younger students. It gives the younger children an opportunity to look up to someone and to develop a big brother within the program. So it develops leadership amongst our children, and it also helps keep it diverse. So the program is ever evolving as those children that are currently participating, they grow up, they get older, and they become the mentors for the younger participants.
Numa is also engaging these boys, young and old, in serious discussions about themselves and their community.
But the fact is, some of you guys want to be mathematicians, engineers, civilians, and you know what? You've saved the work of animals, right?
The Numa founder says the results so far suggest that the program is working well.
Since we started Project Numa, none of the young men have been suspended at all, not one, because the parents allow us to come to the school and to check on their sons. We check report cards, we check grades, we pop up, and we make sure that they stay on task.
14-year-old Virtue Bama says he's always excited about attending NUMA sessions.
This program is very invigorating. This program is very fun for me to be around.
Not only is it invigorating and fun, but kids have stayed with the NUMA project for more than 3 years now, because it offers something many of them are missing in their lives: encouragement, moral support, and consistency. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson made an unannounced visit to Afghanistan Monday to discuss the new U.S. strategy for South Asia with the country's leaders. Tillerson met Monday with Afghan officials, including President Ashraf Ghani. The talks were held at the Bagram Air Base outside of Kabul. VOA's Sarah Williams spoke with VOA correspondent Aisha Tanzim, who was in the Afghan capital, about Tillerson's visit.
Well, what we know is that Secretary Tillerson was here to discuss the new U.S. strategy for South Asia that was announced by President Trump a little while ago. Secretary Tillerson's first visit to Kabul involved his meeting with not just President Ashraf Ghani, but also with CEO Abdullah Abdullah and Afghan National Security Advisor Hanif Atmar. And what we know from the statement issued by the U.S. Embassy in Kabul is that the secretary told the Afghan government that America is committed not just to work with Afghanistan, but also to work with other countries in the region to make sure that there's peace and security in Afghanistan, and also to make sure that the terrorists who are standing in the way of that goal are denied safe havens. Now, when you're talking about safe havens and terrorism in this region, we have to remember that both Afghanistan and the U.S. have long alleged that neighboring Pakistan is providing safe havens to particularly the Haqqani network in the Afghan Taliban. Now, the Pakistani government always denies those charges and claims that it has cleared out whatever safe havens were on its territory through a military operation over the last 2 years. But recently, we saw this charge emerge again more strongly. We saw last week a couple, an American woman with her Canadian husband, were rescued in the region from the Pakistani side of the border after a tip by the U.S. intelligence. We saw CIA Director Mike Pompeo give a statement saying to a Washington think tank saying the couple had been kept in Pakistan for all of the 5 years of its captivity. Those statements kind of contradict what came from Pakistani officials, which was that the couple was moved from Afghanistan to Pakistan very recently. So Secretary Tillerson was here. He's expected to have left the city under very strict security. We didn't know he was here, but we could suspect something was going on. There were a large number of helicopters in the air. But you know that when, you know, Defense Secretary James Mattis came to Afghanistan last month, there was an attack on Kabul airport. So obviously, and during the last 1 week, there have been several attacks in Kabul itself. So security was probably high on the minds of all U.S. officials and, you know, people who were trying to protect Secretary Tillerson, which is why the visit was kept so confidential that I don't even think the State Department press corps knew the exact date and time of when he was going to travel here.
Well, now, Secretary Tillerson, I believe, is staying in, he's left Afghanistan, but is staying in South Asia. Is he going on, will he be stopping in Pakistan?
Yes, I think from Afghanistan, he will go to Pakistan tomorrow and then on to India either tomorrow evening or early Wednesday morning. I don't think he'll spend the night in Pakistan, again, due to security concerns. So he will probably move on to India tomorrow evening. In Pakistan, there have been reports from Washington indicating that he's coming with a tough message. And if we see this rhetoric of safe havens, and today the statement coming out of the U.S. Embassy saying that the Secretary has clarified that U.S. wants to work with partners in the region to deny safe havens to terrorists, that may be one of the big messages he might be bringing to Pakistan. Now, on the Pakistani side, one of their top priorities, one of the messages that they might want to give to U.S. is that they're very uncomfortable with the alleged, with the stated element of the new U.S. policy, which is an enhanced role for India in Afghanistan. Pakistan has always been uncomfortable with Indian presence in Afghanistan. The two countries, India and Pakistan, have always had a roller coaster relationship in their 70-year history of independence from the British. And right now, it seems to be the time and the roller coaster is going downward.
VOA correspondent Ayesha Tanzim in Kabul. Sarah Williams was busy this past week. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson Wednesday met with Indian leaders, including Prime Minister Narendra Modi in New Delhi, during a visit that highlighted the strong emerging alliance between the two countries, combating terrorism, and India's role in helping Afghanistan's development were key issues discussed by Indian Foreign Minister Sushma Swaraj and Tillerson, who arrived in the capital city after stops in Kabul and Islamabad. Anjana Pasricha in New Delhi described to Sarah how India is expected to play its part in the new South Asia strategy promoted by the United States.
I think India is expected to play a far bigger role in this new strategy than it was earlier. India has been a development partner with Afghanistan for a long time now, for 16 years, you know. But I think that role was limited to some extent because Pakistan did not want India to play a very large role in Afghanistan or have great influence there. The U.S. now, however, in the new U.S.-South Asia strategy that it has outlined, said India should be a key development partner for Afghanistan. This is a role that it is willing to play. It's willing to step up. It has already announced 116 new development projects in the region. These are in areas such as health, education, et cetera, you know, water projects that will help the country get back on its feet economically. So there is a larger role envisaged for India. It's a role India is willing and able to do.
But Indian officials have been expressing their continuing concerns with Pakistan in the area of terrorism.
Absolutely. That is India's biggest concern. India blames Pakistan for harboring and sheltering and giving safe havens to terror groups that they say promote insurgency in India, especially in the northern region of Kashmir, the territory that's disputed between the two countries. This has been a long-standing complaint of India, and it has been wanting more international pressure on Pakistan to act against these terror groups. I think this is where India really welcomes the new South Asia strategy, because the Trump administration has now put that pressure on Pakistan. It is calling on Pakistan to eliminate terror havens, to act against terrorist groups, and to do much more than, you know, most people perceive it has been doing so far. So India really welcomes this. But at the news conference, what the Indian foreign minister stressed today was that Pakistan must take action against all terror groups. The reference here is that there are different terror groups which act in Kashmir, and there are different ones which promote terrorism in Afghanistan. And India, I think, is trying to give the message to Mr. Tillerson that Pakistan must not be selective in acting against the terror groups, but must try to stamp all of them out.
Secretary Tillerson has said that he sees India as a key partner facing what he considers negative Chinese influence in Asia. How do U.S. officials feel that India can provide a counterweight to China in this regard?
Well, I think India is also a rising power in Asia. You know, it has a big navy, it has a large army, And although it can't match China's influence or China's, the size of China's economy and size of China's security forces, it is an important power. And I think this is actually what is bringing the U.S. and India closer together. You know, the U.S. sees India as being able to balance an increasingly assertive China, especially in an alliance with other democracies such as Japan and Australia. And India also welcomes this because India is also very suspicious or very concerned about China's assertiveness in the region. There was a tense border standoff between the two countries recently in the Himalayan borders, you know, between the two countries. And this had raised serious concerns about a conflict. So India also would welcome more U.S. support in this regard.
Anjana Pasricha, New Delhi, speaking with International Edition's Sarah Williams. Ahead on VOA Asia Weekend, how a deadly battle in the Philippines has proven to be an embarrassment to an already controversial Philippine president. Japan's ruling Liberal Democratic Party, along with its coalition partner, Komieto, captured 312 of Parliament's 465 lower house seats in last Sunday's snap election, assuring Prime Minister Shinzo Abe a supermajority and improving his prospects of becoming the country's longest-serving prime minister in post-war Japan. Mr. Abe said the election was firstly about the North Korea threat, vowing to pursue strong, resolute diplomacy, and also about Japan's declining birth rate, an issue he described as a national crisis. Jeff Kingston, Asian Studies professor at Tokyo's Temple University, tells VOA's Victor Beatty, absent any strong opposition, there was little doubt the LDP ruling bloc would prevail.
The ruling coalition is still extremely strong, dominant in the Diet, but they did actually lose seats. And the big benefit to the ruling coalition was that they were running against a divided opposition. And when the ruling party is running against more than one other candidate, the opposition divides the anti-LDP vote, and the LDP romps to victory. So this is pretty anticlimactic. Every single poll was projecting a big LDP victory, and at the end of the day, they came through. So I guess Abe will feel vindicated in calling the snap elections early, despite the fact that about 70% of the people didn't think they were necessary.
Assuming that he retains his post as party leader of the LDP, Mr. Abe is set to become the longest-serving prime minister in quite some time.
Yes, he looks like in good shape to win the party leadership elections next September, and that would extend his leadership to 2021. But a lot can happen between now and then. This summer, Abe was down at 26% support in the polls. He had sunk from 60% earlier in the year, and this was due to a couple of scandals and a cover-up involving his defense minister. So the two cronyism scandals haven't gone away, and so after the election dust settles, he's still going to be facing questions because 80% of the public don't believe his denials.
A lot of the news coverage centers on his re-energizing push to revise the country's pacifist post-war constitution. Is that the key issue that's facing voters now?
Well, I think that certainly it was one of the big issues. Normally, elections are fought over the state of the economy and Social Security, pensions, things like that. But clearly, anxiety about the North Korean missile test, I think, created a move to rally around the flag that benefited the LDP. But the constitutional revision issue is one in which the opposition focused and said, you know, this is trampling on Japan's post-war norms and values. And an upstart party led by Yukio Edano, called the Constitutional Democratic Party, more than trebled their seats from 15 to like about 54. And after there's some horse trading post-election, they're likely to have the largest opposition force in the Diet. They'll probably be over 70 seats. But they just did a survey in the news this morning on NHK that found that out of the 465 members of the Diet, 371 favor some form of constitutional revision. So one has to say this election put wind in his sails, but figuring out what to revise and how to revise it could prove divisive.
Jeff Kingston said even if the constitutional amendment passes both houses of parliament, it faces an uncertain future in a public referendum where a simple majority is required for any change. The Japanese Prime Minister's victory in this past weekend's snap election, presumably it leads to a continuation of the policies he has pursued since he took office in December of 2012. A hard line on North Korea, close ties with Washington, including defense, as well as a super loose monetary policy and a push for nuclear energy. I spoke about this and voters' perceptions of Abe with Sheila Smith, senior fellow for Japan Studies at the Washington-based Council on Foreign Relations.
I don't mind calling Abe a nationalist, largely because he would be happy with that label himself. I think he feels the need for a strong Japan, both in economic terms as well as increasingly in its ability to defend itself. So I think that, you know, the nationalist label isn't necessarily inaccurate. But what I worry sometimes is that people take it to mean certain things that it doesn't. So, for example, Abe has implemented a wide array of security reforms during his time as prime minister since he came back in 2012. So people basically believe that Japan is on its way to militarization or to becoming what it was in the 1930s. And I think that's just not the reality. What it's doing, what he has been arguing, is Japan needs a more ready military. It needs to be able to cope with the growing pressure from North Korea, as well as the pressures, especially maritime pressures, from an expanding China.
You bring up militarization, and that, of course, makes its way to Article 9 of the Japanese Constitution. It came into being right after the Second World War. It renounces war, prohibits an army. A lot of people were saying that was on Abe's hit list, but he seems to have come back a little bit on that.
Well, I think he's argued for revision. It's interesting to note over these last several years, he started to use the word amend more than revision, especially when he's speaking in English. I think what he wants to do, and he said this clearly at the beginning of this year, is he wants to add a sentence to Article 9. He doesn't want to change it. Since 1952, when sovereignty was regained from the United States, they have interpreted the Constitution, Article 9 specifically, to mean that they can defend themselves. But not that they can have a military that will, you know, go abroad and create the kind of horror and destruction that it had in the 1930s. So even its name, the Self-Defense Force, reflects this desire to restrain military force only to the purpose of national defense. And so he just wants to put to bed the constitutional question about whether or not that's legitimate under the current Constitution.
What does China think about all of this? If you've been to China, I'm sure you have.
Sure.
You talk to people, and they don't like the Japanese at all, stemming from World War II.
So, of course, and the memory of many people across Asia, not just in China, but in South Korea, in Singapore, in many of the countries where the Japanese military expanded brutally and also were accused of atrocities during that conflict. The memory of that is very severe and has not been forgotten by contemporary generations. That being said, I think China in particular will be very sensitive to whatever the Japanese want to do, not only in the military realm, but in other realms as well. China itself, as we just saw Xi Jinping say in the National People's Congress, that China itself is on the rise and wants a central place. It wants to be ascendant in global politics and regional politics. And so there will be some irritation here that's not just about war memory in the past, but it's really about the aspirations for who's going to be in the leadership of Asia in the future.
Sheila Smith, senior fellow for Japan Studies at the Washington-based Council on Foreign Relations. With air drones now being a fixture in nearly every Army's arsenal, defense industries are hard at work developing ground and underwater robotic vehicles, trying not to fall behind others. Most of this technology has already been developed for industrial robots and the rapidly expanding self-driving vehicle segment of the automotive industry. VOA's George Pudich took a look at the state of warfare robots.
While prominent intellectuals and human rights organizations keep calling for a comprehensive ban on so-called killer robots, some say it is already too late. Weaponized aerial drones are now a standard in every army's arsenal, so the focus shifts to ground and underwater environments.
Today, everybody is flying different kind, different model, different size of unmanned air vehicles, and the trend on the land domain is becoming very, very serious. Just like you see, you know, a level of a semi-autonomous coming in the industry and commercial car business. The military is no different.
This small all-terrain robotic vehicle built by German manufacturer Rheinmetall can easily be adapted to carry lethal weapons. The manufacturer claims the robot will be able to distinguish friends from foes and that it will obey commands of its human operators. But rights organizations such as Human Rights Watch have long expressed concern about the danger of autonomous robotic weapons.
One of the things that holds us back from barbarism in context of war is obviously this distinction between combatants and civilians. And we're worried about, you know, a robotic weapon of the future not being able to distinguish between a child holding out an ice cream and someone holding a weapon.
In today's increasingly polarized world, countries are nervous about the possibility of a potential adversary being able to develop a technology that will give them an advantage in a conflict. Experts say advances in robotics and nanotechnology may shift future conflict underwater, so considerable research is being done in that direction.
The world looks increasingly to the maritime environment for natural resources, and also the ability to operate in the maritime environment is simplified by offboard and autonomous vessels for a whole host of operators. So the requirement for the Royal Navy to be at the forefront of technological thinking to provide the security and protection is only going to increase.
Earlier this year, 126 founders and directors of more than 100 robotic and artificial intelligence companies from 28 countries signed an open letter urging governments to take action for a comprehensive ban on autonomous weapons. But no action has been taken. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
This week's VOA Business Scene with Skyler Ogden focused on China's evolving automobile market, along with wins and losses for Abenomics in Japan.
This is Business Scene. I'm Skyler Ogden. China is making a significant shift towards the electric car business. Geely Holding Company, which owns Volvo, plans to invest $760 million in their electric vehicle brand called Polestar. The first Polestar car will be a two-door plug-in hybrid with 600 horsepower. Hakan Samuelson is the chief executive officer of Volvo.
I think China is also very positive that the Chinese government is also have a very firm strategy going electric, and I think they are promoting electrification. I think that is very positive.
The Chinese government has set quotas for electric and hybrid vehicles and has begun looking at an eventual ban on the sale of cars using fossil fuels. Thomas Ingenlath is the CEO of Polestar.
Definitely there is the big wave of having to have an electric offer in the Chinese market. Again, I think driven by two things. Yes, there is partly the pressure being put on that there's a certain percentage of electric cars that you have to have. On the other hand as well, because it is an attractive offer.
Polestar 1 will go into production in the western Chinese city of Chengdu in mid-2019 and will be followed by a smaller, fully electric Polestar 2. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's third election victory has many shopkeepers in Tokyo shrugging their shoulders. They say the Prime Minister's economic policies, known as Abenomics, simply haven't trickled down to the street level. Shopkeeper Michiko Hachiman.
On a good day, when I was just married, we had lots of customers here in the evening because there were many meat and deli shops. I miss those days, but they will not come back.
On the face of it, Abenomics, a combination of ultra-loose monetary policy and big fiscal spending, has resulted in strong growth and solid business confidence. The stock market is at a 21-year high and unemployment is low. But other economic indicators tell a different story. Debt is almost twice the size of Japan's economic output, wages have stagnated, and deflation continues. 67-year-old shopkeeper Kozo Ito says that visitors here think there is a bank holiday because so many shops are closed.
I tell them, no, they have just shut down.
While Shinzo Abe's victory is seen by some as a vote of confidence for Abenomics, a look at the deserted streets and shuttered stores in Tokyo's commercial district tell a different story. For VOA's Business Scene, I'm Skyler Ogden.
President Trump hosted Singapore Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong at the White House last Monday. That included the two leaders watching the signing of a new Boeing deal with Singapore International Airlines that will create 70,000 jobs in the United States. The previously announced Boeing deal highlighted an Oval Office meeting and a private working luncheon. Trump, who will embark on a 12-day trip to Asia next month, added that the relationship between the U.S. and Singapore is at its highest point, and it will continue.
Both the United States and Singapore understand the unmatched power of private enterprise to uplift the human condition. These values have made our society stronger, sustained our partnership through the Cold War, and laid a critical foundation for our lasting relationship today. Our common values and interests have led to a vital security relationship. Throughout Southeast Asia, the United States and Singapore are currently working to enhance the capacity of law enforcement, fight terrorism, and bolster cyber defenses. Our two nations also share an unwavering commitment to countering the North Korean threat and promoting freedom of navigation in the South China Sea. Singapore was the first Southeast Asian nation to join the coalition to defeat ISIS. That was very far-thinking. You were there before most. More than 1,000 of its military personnel train here in the United States every single year.
Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong urged a good dialogue with China as President Trump makes his first visit there.
President Trump will be visiting China in a few weeks' time as part of his first visit to Asia. Singapore, like many other countries, watch your relations with China very closely. It's the most important bilateral relationship in the world. China is the U.S.'s third largest export market for both goods and services. For agricultural exports, it's the second largest. They buy soybeans, grains, and cotton, as well as farming machinery. And I'm quite sure that as their incomes go up, they'll buy more and more good American beef. I express my hope that the U.S. will be able to maintain a stable and constructive relationship with China. Engaging each other at the highest levels, building trust, establishing institutional mechanisms. Good U.S.-China relations will benefit the region and the world. They will enable countries in the Asia-Pacific, including America and China themselves, to enjoy regional stability, peace, and prosperity.
Although a stop in Singapore is not on President Trump's Asia trip, the Prime Minister extended an invitation for a future visit, which Mr. Trump accepted. The special rapporteur on the situation of human rights in Myanmar, Yang Hee Lee, delivered her report to a United Nations committee Wednesday, saying she finds the events of the past weeks in Rakhine State devastating. Amnesty International has accused Myanmar's security forces of committing crimes against humanity, as more than 589,000 Rohingya have fled for their lives into Bangladesh. VOA diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain had the report from the State Department.
As the mass exodus of Rohingya Muslims continues from Rakhine State in Myanmar to overflowing camps in Bangladesh, the international community is calling for an end to the persecution. Yang Hee Lee spoke to a UN committee Wednesday, saying dangerous and dehumanizing speech tends to precede incidents of mass atrocities.
Unfortunately, there seems to be little sympathy, let alone empathy, for the Rohingya people in Myanmar. For decades, it has been cultivated in the minds of the Myanmar people that the Rohingya are not indigenous to the country and therefore have no rights whatsoever to which they can apparently claim.
Lee said social media had been used to incite hostility and violence against the Rohingya. Myanmar's UN representative disagreed with her conclusions.
We wish the report would have reflected the difficulties of resolving the problems that are a legacy of decades of internal conflict, isolation, and underdevelopment. Therefore, we are disappointed with some of the recommendations which directly or indirectly could hinder our efforts for a democratic transition, peace, and democracy.
But Joanne Lin of Amnesty International USA told VOA via Skype that the human rights organization believes the forced exodus of nearly 600,000 Rohingya Muslims amounts to ethnic cleansing, and attempted to give a sense of the scale of the crisis.
That's comparable to the entire population of Washington, D.C., on the run, fleeing for their lives, children, women, and male civilians.
Some U.S. members of Congress are calling on the State Department to designate Myanmar's actions as an ethnic cleansing. But a senior official said they are not ready to use that term.
I want to be very clear. We are not shying away from the use of any appropriate terminology. We have a deliberative process to examine facts and a policy to support the pursuit of additional information to make such determinations.
Murphy made clear the U.S. is not waiting to take action to hold those responsible for the violence, including by suspending travel waivers for Myanmar's military leaders. Cindy Sain, VOA News, the State Department.
More than half of the nearly 1 million Rohingya refugees who have fled Myanmar into Bangladesh over the years are children. Aid groups are stressing the importance of a return to stability, including school. Steve Sanford spoke to aid workers and students in the refugee camps outside of Bangladesh's Cox's Bazar.
Here in Balukali refugee camp, learning English under a safe roof is comforting for the children. Sisters Fatima and Ayla, who were driven from their home in Rakhine State last month, are happy to recite their latest lesson.
A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, Q, R, S, T, U, V, W, X, Y, Z.
It might all seem pretty basic, but the underlying process is a little more complex, says Jean-Jacques Simone of UNICEF.
The learning centers give children who have just come through the border some sort of a normalcy, or a way back to it at least. And on top of that, obviously they're learning, they're together, they're kids, they're being kids, and they're under this protective environment, which is the learning center.
On the other side of the border in Myanmar, an estimated 60% of Rohingya children have never seen a classroom. Students in poverty-stricken Rakhine State are prevented from traveling to nearby village schools because of government restrictions imposed after the 2012 riots in Rakhine State.
The students cannot go to school, so they have lost their education. Even though there is a school in the other village, they cannot travel because we are so afraid to leave the village. It is not safe to go out for the children.
Human rights groups say the laws are a deliberate move to further constrict the basic rights of the Muslim minority.
For many, many years, the Myanmar authorities have systematically denied the Rohingya population access to education. And this has been part of an overall policy, in our view, that has been highly destructive, deliberately destructive to this community of people.
As many Rohingya children are experiencing school for the very first time, those on the Myanmar side of the border wonder if they will ever get the same chance. Steve Sanford for VOA News, Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh.
This week, after the Philippines declared an end to the Islamic State's control of the southern city of Marawi, Australia announced it is expanding its security support to Manila to focus on urban counterterrorism training. Maurice Payne, Australia's defense minister, spoke on the sidelines of an annual meeting of Southeast Asian defense officials in the Philippines.
The ADF will provide mobile training teams that will begin providing urban warfare, counterterrorism training in the Philippines in the coming days. When you think about people who have been part of the Daesh campaigns in Iraq and Syria, they are battle-trained, they are battle-hardened, they are extremists of the highest order who have been prepared to do the most appalling things, using civilians as human shields, using civilians as collateral in their efforts to try and pursue their perverted ideology.
Australia and other Asian countries are trying to keep track of returning militants who fought in Iraq and Syria, many identified as Indonesian, Malaysian, and Filipino. Despite U.S. and Australian assistance, it took the Philippine Army 5 months to retake the city on Mindanao and left more than 1,100 people dead and hundreds of thousands displaced. Gerard Finan, senior fellow at the East-West Institute in Hawaii, told VOA the fall of Marawi appeared to have undercut the view that President Rodrigo Duterte's roots in Mindanao, a former mayor of Davao City, would be an asset in bringing about peace and order.
So the government's sudden loss of control of Marawi City was therefore a huge embarrassment to his administration. And as you say, the fact that it took some 5 months to regain control, as well as Chinese rifles and U.S. military support, undermined Mr. Duterte's image as a strong leader. You may recall he also declared martial law in Mindanao, but this did not seem to make a significant difference in bringing the conflict to a close.
The incursion raises concerns that Islamic State is making advances to establish a foothold in Southeast Asia, specifically in the southern Philippines.
It's an ongoing challenge and one that was faced by the Spanish and the Americans during colonial times and by the Independent Republic of the Philippines since 1946. But I think it is important to note that there has not been a takeover of a Philippine city like this in a very long time. And so once again, this was a huge embarrassment for a president who tries to portray himself as a strong and decisive leader. I think it also shows that Mr. Duterte's decision to ignore or circumvent the rule of law in the Philippines to achieve results has fallen far short of the promises that were made when he took office.
Regardless, Finan says, the decades-long struggle with Muslim insurgents remains an issue for the country. Media reports indicate that President Donald Trump will meet his Philippine counterpart during his first Asian trip as president next week, and human rights may be on the agenda. Mr. Duterte has been accused of overseeing rights abuses in his country's war on drugs. Aboriginal rangers have discovered some new evidence of one of Australia's rarest and most mysterious birds. The night parrot was feared extinct until it was spotted in 2013. There have been precious few sightings since, but indigenous wildlife rangers say they have photographed one of the nocturnal ground-dwelling birds in the Kimberley region of Western Australia. From Sydney, Phil Mercer has more.
It's just an indistinct flash of pale green and yellow captured on a motion sensor camera, but experts believe Aboriginal rangers have found a new population of one of Australia's most elusive birds. The blurry image taken in Western Australia's Great Sandy Desert suggests the night parrot is fighting back from the brink of extinction. There's also an audio recording. Before 2013, scientists didn't know what the call sounded like. Then a night parrot was found in the state of Queensland. Until recently, the colourful bird hadn't been seen in Western Australia for more than 100 years. The mysterious night parrot, a nocturnal ground-dwelling creature, was thought to have died out due to a loss of habitat, bushfires, and attacks by feral cats. The cats threaten the survival of more than 100 native species and are thought to have killed off a number of birds and smaller mammals. Alexander Watson, a biologist at conservation group WWF Australia, who's worked with Aboriginal rangers in the Great Sandy Desert of Western Australia, says it's an extraordinary discovery.
We brought equipment like sensor cameras and bioacoustic devices to listen for the night parrots. And extraordinarily, we've got a photo of a night parrot flying across one of the sensor cameras. It's a small green parrot with a yellow belly and large head. It could only be a night parrot. We surveyed in areas that the traditional owners knew there were night parrots there.
The night parrot is sacred to First Nation peoples, and experts say Australia now has a second chance to save a bird that was once thought to have died out. The exact locations of recent sightings are being kept secret to protect the recently discovered populations. Researchers hope that more of these mysterious birds will soon be found in other parts of Australia. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This has been VOA Asia Weekend. You can hear our program on iTunes and SoundCloud and voanews.com. Let us hear from you by going to VOA Asia Facebook and email us at voaasia@voanews.com. Our thanks to VOA Asia Managing Editor Diane Gao and our VOA Asia team, Jim Stevenson, David Byrd, and Skylar Ogden. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Enjoy your weekend.